KALW.
Italian frame set, road bike, drop bars, efficient enough to get me where I need to go fast, not comfortable.
San Francisco bike messengers see parts of city life that others don't. Today, we ride along with one.
You go on your little adventures. You might run into somebody. You might meet somebody. You know, it's like a slice of life.
Then, from bicyclists to drivers, a question. What would it take to get you out of your car and onto a bus?
So it's kind of this Goldilocks approach for how do you right-size this design in terms of its technical design and effectiveness, as well as from its fairness.
And Oakland illustrator Minnie Fan reads from her children's book. Our pocket-sized book tour, New Arrivals. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we're starting with a segment from our Culture Keepers series, celebrating the Bay Area's unique spaces and communities.
People just look at it like you're just driving a piece of junk on the streets. But to us, it's like a canvas on wheels.
There's a lot of dirt, rocks, love, and sweat. Maybe a couple of cigarettes.
Do coffee. Do something. No rights reserved, no wrongs preserved.
I felt like I was with my people.
Bicycle messengers were once a vital part of the daily grind of downtown San Francisco, transporting most anything that could be carried from office to office. In recent years, tech tools have made some daily couriers obsolete, but there are still some bike messengers out there. KLW's Zen Iqbal rode along with one of these hardy souls to see how they continue to keep their industry and culture spinning.
A few times a week, Tim McGuire bikes from the Embarcadero BART station towards his office near the ferry building. Well, maybe it's not what most of us think as an office.
We call it the island. It's the island between Embarcadero. Just hanging out, waiting for work.
It's where a lot of bike messengers hang out nowadays. Tim shows up in a yellow t-shirt, black denim cutoffs, and a camouflage baseball cap. He's also missing a couple of teeth, the result of a bike accident unrelated to his job. But it's what else he's wearing and carrying that suggests he might be a messenger. A large, well-worn messenger bag, a leather holster on his belt for his lock, and a defunct pager. Of course, Tim also has a bicycle.
Italian frame set, steel, hot purple. 10-speed, road bike, drop bars. Comfortable enough, but fast enough and efficient enough to get me where I need to go fast. Not comfortable.
Right now, he's checking his phone and waiting for a message from his dispatcher, a buzz signaling the first delivery of the day.
So I pretty much just stay here until I get a job, go grab it, wait till the boss tells me to go to court, do it, come back. It's all pretty enclosed, you know? I'm not going all city like some companies are, which I kind of wish I was, but I'm old, you know? I need to save my energy.
Tim turned 40 in March, and he's been a messenger for just over a decade. He started off delivering flowers on Valentine's Day in 2014, but quickly switched to what he mostly delivers today, legal documents. His days used to be packed, but lately it's slow.
The Superior Court system went to e-filing. It's kind of like the first time when the fax machine came around, and the internet came and email came around.
After about 2 hours of waiting, Tim finally gets a message on his phone from his dispatcher.
We are going to U.S. District Court, 450 Golden Gate.
So, Tim picks up his coffee with one hand and his bike with another. A quick sweep of his leg up and over the seat, and he starts cycling down Market Street.
Yeah, my theory is if you're a bike messenger, you can do anything one-handed. Because usually you have the coffee in one hand.
We capture his ride on a GoPro camera attached to his handlebars. While it does the recording, my job is to keep up with Tim on my own bike. He dodges some pedestrians and zigs across a trolley track. Risky for a cyclist, but Tim rides with the experience of someone who seems to anticipate the timing of every light, every movement on the street. We make a stop at his company's office downtown, First Legal. It's an actual office where he grabs a stack of documents for our run to the courthouse. Tim places them in his messenger bag and hops back on the bike. He doesn't even pull up Google Maps or even check his route.
By the time you're out here for long enough, you hear the name of the client, you know exactly where, you can almost feel it in your legs, the amount of time it takes to get there and get the shit, who you're going to talk to, who the security guard's going to be. Like, it just, it goes in your brain, you know?
We make a right down Minna Street, and after about 15 minutes, we're at the federal courthouse. First ride of the day, done. And on our next ride, he sees a fellow messenger.
Spent a lot of time on 6th Street, too.
Yeah.
I went to a barber college down there.
Oh, right.
That's an old homie. He's been on the road for about as much as me. I don't know. It's cool. It's like it's a culture versus like a job. So yeah, it's like if you see your buddy in the street or, you know, put something on his bike or wave or yell.
Messengers used to take up a lot more space downtown. Their regular hangouts included a spot at the corner of Sansom and Sutter, nicknamed The Wall, or along the plaza at One Post. Carla Lazer remembers these days well.
Hi, Carla.
Hey, how are you?
How are you?
Carla is an unofficial documentarian of bike messenger culture. I visit her in the Lower Haight, where she shares an apartment with a dozen or so vintage Schwinn frames.
This is actually like one of the original racing Schwinns that you're seeing.
Yeah.
And it's a glorious piece.
She also has a collection of bicycle parts, messenger bags.
So these are some of those bags, and this one I've...
And hundreds of photos of bike messengers that she started taking in the 90s. Carla is also the current publisher of Cognition, the world's longest-running printed messenger zine.
And the rule I have is when I hand some to people or if I give some to people to give them to other people, I tell them that they have to say special delivery when they do it. Here's a cool... This is actually Mercury Rising, too.
Oh, okay, yeah.
We sift through old issues of Cognition and other pamphlets. In them, we find snippets of information that clues us into the history of this community, starting as early as the 19th century. According to one pamphlet, a railway strike halted mail delivery in the Bay Area. So, a bicycle shop owner in Fresno came up with the idea to deliver mail by bicycle using a relay system, where riders would cover 30 miles at a time. A decade later, Western Union became one of the first companies to use bicycle messengers to deliver telegraphs. Other companies quickly caught on. But during the 1960s and 70s, the messenger industry started to attract artists who wanted to support their creative pursuits with a less traditional form of work. Many formed bands, punk, ska, metal, and put on shows at different haunts, like The Farm, a former venue in Potrero Hill.
Vigilante 435, needle rocket launcher for a right eye.
As messengers became a larger presence, some got involved in bicycle activism and pushed for changes to make San Francisco the relatively bicycle-friendly city it is today.
We have bike racks all over San Francisco. Before that, you had to lock your bike to a parking meter or something like that. Most of the original San Francisco Bicycle Coalition was comprised of bike messengers.
And messengers saw their share of changes on the streets and sometimes found themselves in the middle of them. Clashes with police, labor strikes, the rise of cycling advocacy such as Critical Mass. They had a street-level view of the rise of technology as the city's economic engine. And messengers had to either figure out their place in this changing world or move on to other jobs. In fact, Carla says the number of messengers out on the road today might be half of what it was some 20 years ago.
I think it's probably closer to 200. I know that it used to be like 500, 600 or more. And then, you know, and then behind every messenger is the dispatcher and all the office workers. And they're, you know, as important as the messengers for any of these roles.
But Carla says this doesn't mean the culture is dying, too. Look hard enough and you'll see bike messenger culture in the clothes people wear, the bags they carry, and on the bikes they ride.
You know, they're bike messengers, but they're actually so many creative, wonderful people. I mean, some are accountants, some are tattoo artists, some have their own different kind of companies, some have their own messenger companies.
As Carla spoke about the resilience of the bike messenger community, who now do everything from food delivery to, believe it or not, mosquito abatement, it took me back to a conversation I had with Tim.
You know, this job has given me a lot. It's given me, like, contentment. It's given me livelihood. It's given me exercise. And And that's why I've sort of been in the job for 10 years, you know, because it's like, you go on your little adventures, you might run into somebody, you might meet somebody, you might, I mean, you know, it's like a slice of life everywhere you turn.
We finished both of Tim's runs, which took a grand total of about 35 minutes. He anticipates he might have it easy the rest of the afternoon.
I'm just going to be hanging around, see what dispatch says, probably have some lunch.
We ride back to the island together, and when we get there, we see a group of messengers, current and former, who have gathered since we left.
I have a face for radio, so. You're still
got a face for radio, you can't even see it.
This morning, there was almost a sense of loneliness as Tim and I chatted, waiting for his first job. But as I listened to some of the other messengers, it felt different. It felt resilient.
Silly way you broke your leg, wasn't it?
Getting back to Bart. I was riding like a messenger, though, at midnight, so.
Oh, there you go.
That's what happens when you ride like a
Messengers, like Tim, keep this unique profession moving. You can see it on the streets, in Carla's next issue of Cognition, or in the banter at the island that keeps the culture alive. A group of riders who thrive on the movement of the continual cadence of the city streets. In San Francisco, I'm Zin Iqbal for Cross Currents.
Zin reported that story as a fellow in our summer journalism program. You can find more stories from our Culture Keeper series celebrating the Bay Area's unique spaces at our website, klw.org/culturekeepers. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. As we just heard, bike messengers used to take up more space in San Francisco's streets. Today, there are less bike messengers and more vehicles and traffic, which I was just in, and I don't have to tell you, it stinks. It's annoying, it's polluting, and it's dangerous. But in cities across the world, there's a system for alleviating congestion. It's called congestion pricing. It's a toll that drivers are charged based on where and when they enter high traffic areas, usually downtowns. The goal is to reduce the number of cars clogging streets while also boosting public transit use, leading to cleaner air and better safety. This summer, New York City was set to become the first U.S. city with congestion pricing, but the program was paused just before it was supposed to go live. Here in San Francisco, transit agencies have been studying congestion pricing for decades. KALW's climate reporter Mary Catherine O'Connor joined me in studio to talk about what it could look like here. Hey, MC.
Hey, Hannah.
All right, so it took me a long time to get here to our studios today. But, I mean, it's not like traffic problems are new, right?
Correct. Transit planners started looking at congestion pricing around 2000, and then they published a big study in 2010. And then right before the pandemic, the city asked the agencies to look at it again because downtown traffic was unbearable. It had gotten much worse due to population increase and also ride-hail services like Lyft and Uber. So the idea around congestion pricing is that fewer cars make the streets safer and let buses move more quickly. That means there's a built-in reward for taking the bus, and then the revenue used from drivers would be put towards better and more transit services, which makes it easier to not drive.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. And on paper, that sounds wonderful. But why did it fail in New York City, though? What happened there?
So it was all ready to go live June 30th. And then just a few weeks before, New York's Governor Kathy Hochul put the brakes on it. She pointed to the cost to drivers. It was going to be $15 to enter downtown Manhattan. She had worries about the impact on struggling businesses downtown. Urban planners and transit folks from like all over the country were really bummed that it had been paused. And I talked to Tilly Chang. She's the executive director of the San Francisco County Transportation Authority. She told me she was hoping New York's system would help inform San Francisco's own planning. Here's what she told me.
We and many others were certainly looking forward to seeing that deploy and seeing what happened. You know, what were the results? Were they as planned and intended?
Okay, so, but what does that mean for San Francisco, though? Does New York's pause throw cold water on the chances we'll do congestion pricing here?
Not really, because we've already had a planning hiatus since the pandemic, when the Board of Supervisors told the agency to put it on pause, all its planning around congestion pricing, because we didn't have much traffic. And actually, the traffic downtown, it hasn't really reached those 2019 levels again yet, though the gridlock on highways, as I probably don't have to tell you, is picking up. It's pretty bad. Plus, a few people told me that because it's such a political hot potato, and this is an election year,
right,
no one's going to talk about it yet. One of the transit advocates I talked to was really hopeful that the city will continue looking and planning anyway now, have it already in place for when and if we get a mayor who's willing to do it,
mm-hmm.
they'll have time to implement it, test it, and see what the benefits are.
Okay, speaking of benefits, we know, you know, what happened in New York is not happening in San Francisco, but we can look to other cities. Where is this working? Where is congestion pricing used right now?
Yeah, so it started in Singapore. That's the old timer. They started in 1975. And then some cities in Norway have been doing congestion pricing for 30 years.
Wow.
London and Stockholm launched their programs in the early aughts, and they were a big deal. People were really mad.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of resistance, but they implemented the programs, and studies have shown that they work. They decrease congestion and reduce emissions. And then residents, they usually come around, right? Mm-hmm. They end up liking it, or at least they don't oppose it anymore.
So what about some more details about our plan here? What are some specifics? How much should this reduce traffic here?
So in the studies the transit agency did, they're looking at a 15% reduction in the number of cars downtown during rush hours. So that would be like one out of every seven drivers decides, okay, I'm not going to drive downtown during rush hour on any given day.
So here's a question that I think a lot of people would want to know. Where downtown would the congestion pricing be applied?
So the main zone would be Van Ness to Embarcadero, and then also north and south of Market Street, so Financial District and SoMa. A larger possible zone would be that, plus North Beach and Mission Bay. Tilly told me designing the congestion pricing zones, it's really tricky.
Can't be too small because people will go around it. It can't be too big because that whole area might not be as well served by transit as you would like. So it's kind of this Goldilocks approach for how do you right-size this design in terms of its technical design and effectiveness, as well as from its fairness and its burdens and its benefits.
Okay, and then how much is this going to cost drivers? Big question.
Yeah, well, the study looked at $6.50 per vehicle. And here's Tilly again explaining why that number.
So the $6.50 came up through scientific studies about, you know, given all the travel choices and the time-money trade-off that motorists of different incomes might make, that was the sort of market-clearing figure at the time for what it would take to get a demand reduction.
But there would be discounts, and those would be based on income level or if, say, you can't take transit because of physical accessibility limits
mm-hmm.
and you have to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Uber and Lyft drivers, they'd also have to pay, of course, and they'd be open to the same discounts. But how and if that gets passed on to fare payers is to be determined. Payment would be collected via transponder, so just like your fast track transponder, and the readers would be installed like along the streets above them, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, okay, $6.50, that's about the same as crossing a bridge into the city, even a little less.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there's one of the ideas is that there'd be a discount for bridge drivers, right? So if you already drove in over a bridge, the transponder would have marked that and you'd get an extra discount. But Tilly actually said that most of the drivers downtown SF are San Francisco residents.
So how do you think drivers here would react to a congestion pricing scheme in San Francisco?
Well, the other day I went up to Sutter and Kearney and asked people, and overall the sentiment was either really strongly pro or con, right? One person called driving a luxury that she affords herself. Another person said he only drives a couple days a week. His boss already pays him to park, so he'd probably just tack it on. No big deal. Now, I should say, most of these people were driving out of parking garages.
Uh-huh.
They're already laying out some cash
right.
to drive downtown. Other people were outraged at the mere idea of paying to drive downtown. Here's what one commuter, Mo Azat, told me when I asked him if he'd pay.
No, absolutely not. How can I afford that? That's going to be an added cost on top of the cost of gas and on top of the cost of the car itself, whether I'm paying payment, insurance, it's too much.
Could you take public transit downtown?
I could if public transit was, I guess, available everywhere, if it was closer to my house.
Where do you live?
I live by, you know, where's Park Merced area?
Park, yeah.
Yeah, by 19th Avenue. Yes. If it was, also if it was clean and safe.
I mean, we hear concern there, definitely. But MC, aren't people also worried that congestion pricing hurts the folks who can least afford it? People who are already struggling to live in the Bay Area.
Definitely. Tilly Chang stressed that the city really wants to keep fairness and equity at the heart of the program. One immediate benefit should be that bus travel would improve, right? So lower income folks are more likely to be on public transit. As of 2019, Muni, so we're talking the bus and the light rail system in San Francisco, it served more low-income transit riders than all other transit services in the Bay Area combined. Plus, research shows that most people who drive downtown during peak congestion are pretty high income. So based on that, the wealthy would shoulder most of the financial burden.
Okay, so where does this leave us? How likely are we to see congestion pricing coming to downtown San Francisco in the next few years?
Well, if and when it moves ahead, there's a bunch of next steps, right? The city would have to do environmental review. There'd be design and testing, a lot of public outreach. And then it has to go to the state. The state legislature has to approve it. So there's lots of steps. And the last thing is that there's currently a survey happening right now by transit agencies across the region. They're trying to get an understanding of what do the travel patterns look like since 2019. And the results of that are really going to inform what happens next.
Okay, we'll be following along with you. Thank you, MC.
Thank you.
Mary Catherine O'Connor is KALW's climate reporter. Find all her coverage at KALW.org/crosscurrents. And transit issues will be on the ballot this year, with San Francisco set to vote on Proposition L, which would increase funding for Muni. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Up next, a reading from New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour. KALW is full of multi-talented people. Take, for example, our development and communications manager, Minnie Fan. Minnie lives in Oakland, and when she's not repping KALW, she's a prolific illustrator and writer. Her new book, Simone, is about a Vietnamese-American girl whose life is transformed by wildfire. It's a picture book graphic novel hybrid, and it's written in collaboration with Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Simone is about wildfires and a Vietnamese family's experience with climate change. Here's one of my favorite parts from the book, where Simone and her mother, Ma, evacuate from their home.
Everything will be okay, baby.
I know. I've been through this before.
Really? With a fire?
With water. Before I came here, a flood.
The roar of the plane startled me. I'd never seen one fly so low. Ma was born in Vietnam. She came here on a plane. I've never been there. She always said it was a beautiful country. Ma promises she'll take me one day.
Simone, I'll never forget the flood. I was only a little girl back then, your age.
all I could bring was my crayons. They were my most precious things. Nook everywhere. Ma is the only Vietnamese word I know. What's nook? Nook means water, but it also means country. A country of water?
That was Minnie Phan reading from her book, Simone. It was written in collaboration with Viet Tan Nguyen and came out in May. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. Find more readings from Bay Area authors at klw.org/newarrivals. Before we leave you, here's some music from a Bay Area band. This is Berkeley's Tree Cage. They'll be playing in their city tomorrow at 924 Gilman. Today's Cross Currents team includes Aru Nair, Afton Okwu, Julia Haney, Cherie Bishop, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.